From our 901 Mission Street studios, you are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle.
Welcome to Total SF, and welcome back to Independent Bookstore Tribute Month to my wife, librarian Kelly Hartlob. Welcome back to our living room.
Oh, thank you. Our living room slash your office space slash seventh grade classroom.
Seventh grade classroom. I am now sharing the desk with my son. I gotta say, from the seventh grader, from you, from me, a lot of excitement in our household about the next guest on Total SF, beloved author and graphic novelist Raina Telgemeier.
Oh my God, I'm starstruck by Raina Telgemeier. She is one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah, she's a superstar. Her fifth original graphic novel, Guts, came out last year about her middle school battles with anxiety and panic attacks. And it was like the best-selling book in the nation. Not best-selling kids book, not best-selling graphic novel, best-selling book, and Stephen King and Malcolm Gladwell had books out that same month.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, she is absolutely gigantic. But this is extra special because she's not on a book tour, so we really got to talk about the Bay Area. We talk about her first bookstore where she fell in love with reading. Not what I was expecting. You'll have to listen. She talks about how she's worked the Bay Area's landmarks and even the weather into her books. And we talk a lot about indie bookstores, specifically Green Apple Books on Clement in San Francisco, where she still signs books for mail order.
Wait. What?
Yeah.
How can she, that's a lot of books.
Yeah, she's sold, I think, around 20 million books, like, worldwide. Now, not all of them have gone out of Green Apple Books, but a huge number. And she'll still sign a book. It's on her website. If you want a signed book, get it out of Green Apple. Green Apple will mail it anywhere for 99 cents. And she actually even sent me a photo later. It's like a little school, like, classroom desk.
Oh, yeah.
And she's sitting there with just this gigantic pile of books.
We need one of those desks for our seventh grade classroom.
Yes.
I think her next book might be about a main character who develops carpal tunnel syndrome.
Yes. I think she should take a little time before her next book. I think like a few years between books because she's earned it. She works really hard. I've seen her at a middle school event. And she talks about it in the podcast that imagine being like at a rock concert and performing, and then when you're done, meeting every single person at the concert.
Yeah.
That's what she does. Energy is up. Our son kind of walks into the podcast. He was invited. But and you get a taste of that in this podcast. She's just wonderful. I really love this interview. I can't wait for you to hear it. You haven't heard it yet. And I can't wait for all of our Total SF listeners to hear it and support independent bookstores. And I think she really gets that message across.
Can't wait to hear it.
Raina Telgemeier coming up. I'm Peter Hartlob, and this is Total SF.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to Total SF, Raina Telgemeier, and I am so excited to have you on my podcast. Welcome.
Thank you, Peter. It's nice to be on your podcast.
Yeah, this is not going to be a podcast that's heavy on dire current events, but I wanted to just ask you, how are you doing?
Doing okay. I think I may have been well suited to a pandemic a long time ago, only because I work from home and I'm an introvert. And the part of my career that doesn't mesh well with this is the fact that I travel tons to go to like schools and libraries and bookstores all over the country and all over the world. And that's the part of my schedule that got wiped out. But it's given me a great chance to kind of refocus on, you know, how much I enjoy being alone. So I wouldn't say it's nice because this is not exactly like taking a staycation. But it's not the worst either. I'm finding ways to enjoy myself pretty much every day.
Yeah, and you were coming off book tour, so I'm wondering, is this a time to relax? And do you do that by reading?
I was doing a lot of reading while I was traveling. So, you know, like listening to audiobooks in the car and reading on airplanes and stuff. And so now it's more like I have to find the time to read, even though there's more free time. I'm finding it's my favorite way to wind down at the end of the night and to, you know, wake up in the morning sometimes.
I just assume you're reading graphic novels too, but maybe you're reading historical nonfiction and that's all, and I don't know it. Do you tend to read a variety, or are you, you know, reading YA stuff while you're not writing?
All of the above. I do love comics and graphic novels, but it seems that when left to my own devices, I listen to people's memoirs and I listen to a lot of nonfiction that has to do with like social psychology and like the internal state. And I don't know if it's because I just came off of writing a book about those subjects and about anxiety that now I'm still sort of in like study mode, or to be honest, like now people want to talk to me more about things like anxiety because I wrote a book about it.
And that's so your book, Guts. That's your
my
most book,
recent Guts.
Book. Yeah.
Yeah, which is about my childhood and having a panic disorder and then sort of living with that for the rest of my life. And so people now want to talk to me about it. So I'm like, I'd better read a lot and study so I sound like I know what I'm talking about instead of just relaying my own experiences. But I just listened to a book called The Deepest Well on audio, and the author of that is Nadine Burke Harris, who helped to establish the Center for Youth Wellness in Hunters Point. And they studied childhood adversity very carefully over the course of many years there and learned a lot about how, you know, where you grow up and what your life is like and whether you're in a great neighborhood versus a neighborhood that has, you know, shootings on the street, like how much those things are going to contribute to you being traumatized or your susceptibility to illness when you're older. And I think this is just something I've been interested in a long time, but the book was recommended to me. And I, not only did I feel like she just beautifully addressed this subject and has been interested in it for so long, but she's just a really cool person. Mm-hmm. So I felt like we were buds afterwards. And then I learned that she was elected to be California's Surgeon General. So she's my favorite person.
Nice.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed that. And I'm also listening to Becoming right now by Michelle Obama. And I feel like it's the same thing where I'm like, we are definitely best friends right now. And it's like nice to go back in time to when we were all feeling like politics is an awesome place and we're all feeling so hopeful and we're all so optimistic about things. And I don't want to dive into politics too heavily right now, but there's like a little tear running down my cheek listened to it.
No, I mean, her DNC speech was so great. And have you listened to her podcast?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. The first one with Barack Obama was just like bomb for my soul in 2020.
They're the cutest, basically. And I don't know, I just respect and admire them so much. But I have been reading a lot of comics. I'm not reading novels for some reason, but I'm reading graphic novels. And I've been working my way through the Strangers in Paradise series by Terry Moore, which came out in like the 90s, which was around the time that I started getting into independent comics. But for whatever reason, I never read Strangers in Paradise. Maybe because it's definitely an older skewing series. And I've always gravitated towards the young stuff and towards the YA audience material, but I'm loving it. It's so comprehensive. It just dives into like relationships and also murder. But I read the murder parts quickly and then come back to just like the friendship. And have you read Strangers in Paradise?
I have not.
Oh man.
So much of my comic book reading I read right up until about 87, 88 and then stopped. For dumb reasons. I mean, you know, social reasons. I liked it. I just, my social circle wasn't doing it. So late in high school, I stopped reading them and started again in the 90s, late 90s. And just everything since then, I'm going into comic book shops and finding all the stuff I missed.
Yeah.
So I will add that to my list. And I'm starting to read new stuff too. I just read, this is a, sorry, I'm holding it up, but the Satchel Paige.
Oh, that's one of my dad's favorites.
Oh, it is so fantastic. I put it on like my top five ever. So I've been reading some new ones, but that's kind of new. I do a lot of catching up on the stuff that I missed when I wasn't reading comics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I also just read a book called Duran Duran, Imelda Marcos, and Me. which was by Lorena Mappa, and it's a memoir about her childhood growing up in the Philippines during the People Power Revolution.
Is it graphic novel?
Yes, it
oh,
is.
Oh, wow, I'm in.
It's really cool.
Just the title. You had me at
Duran. I know. It's like if you're our age and you remember those days. So it's, yeah, I really like that one too. And then I'm not done with it yet, so I'll put it last on my list, but I'm reading a YA graphic novel called Beetle and the Hollow Bones by Aliza Lane. And it's like the perfect Halloween-y, witchy, goblin-y, like adorable, learning how to do stuff, coming of age graphic novel.
It's so important living in the Bay Area. And I think people outside of the Bay Area don't understand this, but there's very subtle shifts in the weather and the atmosphere. And those are changing. They're different than when I was a kid. So to get into Halloween, I feel like I have to like wrap lights around something, you know, and get the jack-o'-lantern. Otherwise it didn't happen. You know, you can just miss it entirely.
It's very subtle. I know. Yeah. And I grew up here too. And so I always associated Halloween with like summer weather, because this is usually the sunniest time of the year in this area. And everything leading up to Halloween is like fog and cold and wind and just like mist in your face. Like that's the summer vibe. And then Halloween is like when you put your sunglasses on. So it's different here. We don't get the fall leaves. We don't get that change of the seasons. But I feel like I'm pretty attuned to like what position the sun is in the sky and what time the sun is going down. And so as soon as it starts to get early or dark early, I'm like, oh, Halloween is coming. So yeah, it's, and the book that I wrote that sort of makes or takes the most advantage of that is my book Ghosts, which takes place in sort of a fictionalized Half Moon Bay.
I felt it was like Half Moon Bay, Bodega Bay and
Monterey.
Yeah. Yeah.
Santa Cruz. Yeah, it's just like I just mushed all of the towns that are on that part of the coast together and came up with a fictionalized one where ghosts absolutely exist.
I appreciate that your characters wear layers even when it's summer, which I think your readers who are like on the East Coast must wonder what's going on, that there are no seasons in your books, but I'm like, no, that's what it's like.
My editor, who's a New Yorker, like longtime New Yorker, he was like, you know, in Smile, which takes place over the course of 5 years of my childhood, he was like, we don't really understand how the passage of time works in this book, and it doesn't seem like anything ever changes or you're getting older. I'm like, yeah, welcome to San Francisco, thank you. So you're absolutely right, there's always a jacket and a hoodie.
So you grew up Park Merced or near Park Merced.
Yep.
Do you remember what like your first experience was just getting into reading? Was there a moment where you suddenly decided that you like reading, and do you remember it?
I remember bits and pieces of it. I mean, my parents are both book people and writers and teachers, and so they had tons of books in the house, and my brother and sister and I were all, you know, read from the time we were infants. And I remember watching cartoons, which I also did a ton of. And at the end of the cartoon, they would show like a couple of credit cards. What are they called? Title cards? Like,
yeah.
With the credits on them, you know, it's a card, but it's not called a credit card. And looking at, you know, what would have been people's names and their credits, and me thinking, someday I'm going to know what that says. I can't wait till I can decipher all of those mysterious shapes. You know, and like I was a big Sesame Street fan. So I think just like understanding words and reading came gradually. But then I do recall being in kindergarten and learning to read a book, which was obviously meant for a 5-year-old to read, and just feeling like, all right, I got the world in my hands now. This is great. And then, you know, I have my diaries still from when I was in first grade and some of like my spelling tests and stuff. And I was already thinking at age 6 about the ways that people speak and trying to capture like accents and cadence in my like earliest childhood writing. It's really, really fun to look back and see that. And I remember going to bookstores with my parents, and it was something we did. And the first bookstore that I had a relationship with was the student bookstore at San Francisco State University.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
Because my dad was a professor there, and it was, it was like 4 blocks from my house. And so he would like pick me up after school, and my bus stop was on the campus. And he'd be like, "You want to go to the bookstore?" And we'd just walk over to the student union and then pop in. And I haven't been there in a while, so I don't know if the architecture is still the same, but it had these big, like, concrete beams and like all these weird angles that ran through it, and like just big picture windows. The light would just stream in the afternoons, and we would just spend hours. And it was just like, you go look at your stuff, I go look at my stuff. Do you want something? I'll buy it for you. And he noticed that when I turned 9 or 10, I started reading comic strips in the newspaper and fell in love with them. So we were at SFSU, and he like appeared from behind a bookshelf and was like, "Hey, Raina, I got something to show you." And he pulled out the first collection of Calvin and Hobbes comic strips.
Oh.
And he was like, "Check it out." And I was like, "There's a book of Calvin and Hobbes. Are you kidding me?" And that was it. Like that was the beginning of that story. And nothing has changed. I'm still...
I was gonna
going
ask,
to bookstores and buying comics.
I was going to ask, what kind of children's literature or section did the SFSU bookstore have?
They had
but it had Calvin and Hobbes, so
yeah, that I mean, those books used to be in like the humor section of bookstores, but they had a pretty decent children's section, and I remember buying, you know, my Beverly Cleary books and my Trudy Bloom books, my Super Fudge and everything that I was into prior to getting into comics. I don't remember too well where like picture books ended and chapter books began. I don't know if I was like excited by that or disappointed by that. I just know that when I found comics, I was like, this is the perfect combination of the things that I love. I love artwork, I love pictures, I love drawing, and I love stories, and I love the way that people speak. And so in comics, it's like all of the dialogue is coming right out of their mouths and word balloons. And I don't know, it just struck such a deep chord for me. I never turned back.
Do you remember the first ones that grabbed you? Calvin and Hobbes?
Yes.
Surely. I'm hoping you were reading these in the Chronicle, but if it was the
Examiner. No, we don't tell anybody, but we didn't subscribe to the Examiner when I was growing up. We were a Chronicle family.
Oh, that's okay.
I know.
That's okay. I worked for the Examiner for a year, so I still... But
if they were still around, I'd feel bad saying that, but since they're not, we can...
Yeah, I delivered both. So what were the ones that kind of grabbed you? Do you remember?
I do. I loved Luann by Greg Evans. It's just like middle school soap opera. And I loved Fred Bassett for some reason. It was just like a guy and his dog. And then For Better or For Worse was the one that just took it all. And I fell in love very quickly. The kids in that strip were my age. So it was like, how does she know what's going on inside of my head? How is she so attuned to the way that people think and feel and talk and their relationships? And I mean, talk about a soap opera. That strip went on for 29 years and you got to grow up with those characters because they aged in real time. It's interesting to think about how comic strips have or had rules. But one of them was that you just like never changed clothing. So the character always had to wear the same thing. So like Dennis the Menace, always going to be in overalls. Yeah. And when I started making comics later, and when my comics were still in black and white, because for a long time they were, people were like, "I can't really tell who's who. They change clothes all the time." And so I don't know. It's interesting to learn like what people's eyes gravitate towards and whether they really pay attention to like the character designs, if they're not pushed so far as like the way Peanuts characters were, where Charlie Brown is bald. And Linus has that hair on his head that looks like sticks, and he's wearing a striped shirt, and Lucy has dark hair. My character designs have always been a little more subtle and realistic, and I do take that away from For Better or For Worse, too, that style of drawing. I think now I pay more attention to that sort of thing and try to push my character designs in different directions. But yeah, it was something to learn, for sure.
Did you feel like you could be part of that world? I mean, was that what you wanted to do, is make a strip? Or did you feel like what you wanted to do and what you were good at and what you could do could be a career?
I tried. I tried to emulate what I liked, and it never really worked for me. Like writing punchlines was difficult. and knowing that you had to come up with a punchline every single day of the year and that there were no breaks and that you had to be working, what is it, like 6 weeks or 6 months or so? You're way, way, way ahead of schedule. So it's hard to be timely. And I think now, like, the way that people work on comic strips, a lot of them are, you know, being published online instead of in papers. So the way the syndicate happens, it's very possible that things are happening a little bit tighter now. So you can kind of keep up with current events better. But yeah, I tried it and tried to, like, show my classmates and my family the comic strips I was writing. And I never got a laugh out of anybody. They were always like, haha, that's nice. That's cute. That's funny. When someone says that's funny, that is not the same as a person actually laughing at a joke. So had a lot of those, like, sort of lukewarm responses. And so I was like, I'll never be a cartoonist. This is terrible. And the only other option that I knew of was to draw superheroes. And I didn't really get into reading superheroes for whatever reason. I didn't start going to comic book shops until I was in my 20s. So what I knew was comic strips, and then started reading a little bit more Indian alternative stuff when I was a little bit older and started to see, like, the different formats that were available and the different types of publishers that were out there. And I think the label over all of that was just indie comics. So I thought, okay, I can be an indie cartoonist, whatever that means. I'll sort of just figure it out. And after college, most of what I did was to draw, like, short story comic book pages. Mm-hmm. And then I published them as mini comics. I was just Xeroxing everything. But I was able to sell them at local stores. Like, Comic Relief had a little box with my name on it that was like, here's the little tiny Raina Telgemeier section. And I remember seeing that. This would have been in, like, 2003 or something. And I was like, I know that I've made it because I have a little box at Comic Relief. So, yeah. But yeah, so really bookstores were where I got most of my bearings when I was young.
What bookstores were near you, and what comic book shops, what was kind of your first comic book shop? Because I had a similar experience. I had the comic book rack, and then a couple of random stores would have them. I didn't go to a comic book shop till I was like 16, and it was in San Carlos. I had to get on like my 10 speed. I lived in Burlingame, right on the San Mateo border, but I had to get on my 10 speed and ride, like, you know, 6 miles.
What was the store called?
I don't know the name. I've mentioned it to other comic books people, and it blows their mind because the guy is apparently kind of famous. His name's Tibur. He was he rode around in a dune buggy and it was one of the old school comic book shops where, I mean, everything was in boxes and a little bit of a mildewy smell and everything, which is not the way most of them are now. I mean, it was kind of this old school thing. But I still don't to this day know what it was called. I'm sure it was something nondescript.
Peter, you're an archivist. I feel like you should access to, okay, new project.
This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to find out the name. Okay. And then when I record the intro of this, I will have the name.
Awesome. Because I used to go to Lee's in San Mateo.
Sure.
That was where I bought all my bone trades. And I went to, like, Amazing Fantasy on Irving Street. And that was right next to Black Oak Books, which was one of the stores that my dad and I both loved to frequent because they had so much used book stuff. And it's not there anymore. It's such a shame. It was such a great location and it was such a nice, welcoming space. But I feel like, you know, we've had a lovely proliferation of indie bookstores in the Bay Area in the last 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. Ones that have been around for a long time have been joined by newer ones. And so it's just, I don't know, I feel like we're living in sort of a cool golden age, but pandemic is making that weird and hard. But I mean, I also spent time at, like, Walden Books and B. Dalton at that little, like, there was what's that little shopping plaza that's below Saramonte, but it's not Saramonte. It's like across the street.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. There was a Walden Books in there that we spent a lot of time at.
What was the Stonestown's bookstore? It had to be one of the, they had to have one.
Man.
The kind of the little airport sized bookstores they used to have in every mall. I don't remember. Hillsdale, I think it was B. Dalton.
It would I've been to that one. It's weird. I can only think of the Borders that was in Stonestown.
Yeah.
Did they have a bookstore? Okay, more archive work. We have jobs.
A lot of work to do. what about as you're ascending and you know, the stories I've written about it, and you started with Smile, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And then that was a hit, and while this is going on and you're getting just more and more traction, how did indie bookstores in the comic book shops fit into that? Because I feel like what you do has a sensibility that's really great for them. It's like almost like the symbiotic thing that your books sell really well. Every time I go in one, there's a whole shelf. And yet what you do feels like to me what I went to a comic book store for.
Yeah.
There's something more personal about it. And I'm curious what those places meant to you as your career was ascending.
Well, I did what you're not supposed to do when you're a native San Franciscan, which is that I left and I went to school in New York and then stayed in New York for a total of 16 years. So my first experiences with comic stores were mostly in New York City and in some of the surrounding areas. But I've developed a pretty good relationship with comic book stores because they often were the ones that were running like the independent comics festivals. So mm-hmm. like there's a store in Portland, Maine called Casablanca Comics, and the owner there like has a festival every year, and he invites a bunch of cartoonists to come and exhibit, and we get to meet the folks of Portland, Maine. And so I developed a lot of relationships with stores through events like those. And then when a book would come out, they'd say, oh, this is great. Like, come back to Portland and we'll host you and we'll, you know, have a book signing for you. And it'll be so great. And before bookstores had really kind of clued into this graphic novel movement that was happening in the mid-aughts, the comic stores were there for me. Mm-hmm. So I was still like, in some cases, selling my mini comics through them. And then they were carrying like the Babysitter's Club books that I was working on. And you know, there were times for sure when I would do a signing and like two people would show up because it just, this thing, whatever it is that you want to call it, this movement, the popularity of graphic novels for kids just had not taken hold yet.
Yeah.
It took a while before bookstores were willing to host me. I don't want to say willing, that's the wrong word, but before, you know, I would do a bookstore event where people would actually show up. And it wasn't until after Smile was published in 2010 and then Sisters in 2014 and Drama in 2012. Like that was when Scholastic started to put me out onto book tours. And in every case, they were working with indie bookstores. So all over the country, I was being hosted by indies. And then like my relationship with those people started to grow. And it's really always felt like it's the people, you know, the people that own the stores and then their patrons who they know so, so well. And I mean, one of my very first like big events was at a store called Kids Books in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And they know like every single kid who lives in Vancouver and every parent to those kids. And so they were like, you haven't heard of this book yet, but this is what it's about. This is why you're going to like it. This is why you should invite your friends. And, you know, I hadn't had a lot of experiences with big events. This is in 2011. And I showed up for the event and there were people waiting outside to get in and they went all the way around the block.
Oh, Star Wars film.
Basically, I think they said it was like 125 people and it was like completely unprecedented. But they had also designed like a huge window display and they just pulled out every stop. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is what it means to be an author and to have kids waiting to meet you who have photographs of like the birthday cake that they had this year, where it's like the cover of Smile is on their cake. And do I still have that picture behind me? I don't know if I do, but it's been in my house for a long time because it's like such a treasure. Yeah, and since then it's grown, and now I can't even do events in the stores. We have to find venues in towns.
Junior high, I went to once and saw you at. It was like a concert.
It was like a concert, except I don't sing on stage. So, but yeah, it's a concert where then you spend 2 or 3 hours afterwards meeting and greeting with every person in the audience.
So speaking of which, this is going to be a really bad segue, the worst segue of this podcast. Milo, come here. Can my son say hi really quick? He is such a super fan.
Hello, hi.
Hey, Milo. How's it going?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Oh, that's nice.
How's your shelter in place going so far?
It's going pretty good. School's a little bit hard, but...
A little hard? Yeah, it's a little hard for me, too.
Yeah, it's really nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you, too. Oh, and you've got braces, too.
Oh, yeah, I got them recently.
Did you?
Yeah.
How do they feel?
All right, anyway, I would probably be a lot less confident if I hadn't read this, but...
Oh! Hey, that smile that you just happen to have right there in front of you. How convenient.
Exactly. We have all your books.
Yeah, I think that's...
Oh, man, you guys are the best!
All right, well, it was really nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. Maybe at some point I'll meet you in person.
Maybe, yeah, after this is all over.
Exactly.
Yeah, all right, bye.
Bye, Milo.
Thanks, bud. Bye, see ya. Appreciate it.
No problem.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
With what's going on now, I mean, I'm sure you saw some of these stores and shops over and over, year after year, or, you know, whether as a patron or someone who's visiting, has a relationship as an author, how much are you thinking about them right now and you know, the survival of these independent bookstores and comic book shops and their future?
It's constant. It's like... These are the people that I'm friends with now on Facebook and I follow on Twitter. And so I do get to see their personal thoughts and feelings as the pandemic has unfolded. And so anytime I do a podcast or an online event or anything, I try to tie it in with the store somehow, just to be able to say like, hey, if you enjoyed this panel, like go get some books and here's a great place to get them from. So yeah, I mean, there are so many stores. I wish I could do an event with and for every store, but you know, I still am able to work with Scholastic to make some of that happen. And I still do have, of course, my indie store here in San Francisco that I work with. So you can still get signed copies even during a pandemic.
So I think that's amazing because any bookstore I go to now, your book is everywhere. I don't know what the sales figures are. I will research that too. But the last time I wrote a story, I found them and they were incredible. And yet, Green Apple Books, anybody who wants to order a book there can get a signed copy. And that's been going on for how long? How did that relationship start?
I had been a customer of theirs, probably starting in high school. I had a boyfriend who lived in the Avenues. So when we were teenagers, we used to just like bum around on Clement Street. And so just like many hours passed in the stacks at the bookstore. And so then
a lot of Toy Boat, a lot of Green Apple.
Toy Boat, RIP. I'm so sad.
No, it's
sad.
Back. It's back. I got good news for you.
Oh my gosh. Is that...
It's got a new owner. It's Toy Boat by Jane, but it's Jane the Bakery, who's a local.
I love Jane the Bakery.
She bought Toy Boat.
I am so San Francisco happy right now. This is
little
awesome.
Little less clutter. I loved the, I think it was the Fink family, but it's a little cleaner now, and it's open, and they're serving. You're going to get to go back to Toy Boat next time you go
goodness.
Sign 6,000 books at Green Apple.
This is so... I'm so happy to hear that. Okay, great. Well, my day is made.
Let's describe Green Apple to people because
yes, please.
Let's do it together. I lived when I came back to San Francisco in '99. I lived three blocks from there. I stayed with my aunt before I got a place, and working for the Examiner and then later the Chronicle. But Green Apple became, I mean, just my second home. I probably went three times a week, and I think it's a really unique store, and it's special in that I still couldn't draw a map of it for you.
Right.
It's sort of a labyrinth-like bookstore. It may be the biggest bookstore. You know, I don't know if City Lights is bigger.
It's got a lot of square feet. I mean, it's kind of like the Winchester Mystery House of bookstores.
Yes.
There's not like two distinct levels. It's kind of like four and a half levels. There's mezzanines and there's creaky stairwells and there's like scary hidden bathrooms and stuff. It's amazing. And
yeah.
it just feels like a place of discovery. Like, you think you know what you're getting when you walk into a bookstore if you've only ever been to something like Barnes & Noble. No disservice to Barnes & Noble. I love Barnes & Noble. But when you walk into Green Apple, you're just like, what is this magical mystery place?
So many bookstores now, and I don't blame them. I love them. I have one locally. I love Books, Inc. and Alameda.
They're
like kind of got the open floor plan, like the open kitchen. Like everybody's got the open kitchen now. And it's the open floor plan and everybody can see each other and you can fit, you know, 150 people in maybe for a book talk. Green Apple, Heather Knight and I were going to do something there and we're like, oh, you know, how many hundred? They're like, no, like 25.
And
yep. You have the biggest bookstore. But it's because it's, as you said, kind of just this place of discovery.
It is.
And you were going there as a teen.
I was. And then I did an event with them right after Smile came out. I was just doing like my own little book tours and it was great. Like you said, I think about 20 people fit into their event space and it was like all my high school friends. And so there's not even a place to put up like a screen to show slides. So I just like brought my laptop. Like, here you guys. Thanks for coming. It was adorable. And then I did another event with them in 2012 with a couple of other graphic novelists it was an official Scholastic event. So they've just been with me for quite some time. And then when I moved back to San Francisco in 2015, I had been working with a store in Queens, which is where I lived. It was the Astoria Bookshop. Mm-hmm. And they moved into Astoria just a couple of years before I moved away. And it was just like, oh, hey, my neighborhood has a bookstore. Cool. And so I can like be there, one of their local authors. This is great. So I used to do sign stock with them. And it was like a 1.5 person operation for the first several years. So I just had a great relationship with the bookseller there. And then when I moved back to California, I was like, okay, I need a new one. Who's it going to be? And me and the rep at Scholastic, like, it wasn't even a conversation. We were like, it's Green Apple. And I had an apartment not too far away. So it was easy for me to just pop by. And it just, you know, it just became like my second living room. And this was right before Ghosts was published. It was between Sisters and Ghosts. And so, I don't know, they started selling my books online, signed, and I started doing like big promotions at Christmas time where we'd say, hey, if you want a signed book personalized and drawn in, you know, this is where you can get it. And they, I don't know if this is a good business model or not, but they will ship anywhere in the country for 99 cents to this day. Yeah. So that's awesome. Right. Like that's a great incentive for somebody who lives in New Hampshire to want to buy a signed copy of a book. So we got just like slammed with requests, and that's not a bad thing.
You say it's not a bad thing, but I mean, how many thousands of books is it?
At this point, it's been multiple dozens of thousands probably.
But how do you do that? Is there a truck involved?
No, just really strong backed booksellers. In small rooms always. No, they have one of their rooms has this little like school desk in it. Actually, it's the philosophy room. So they would just like bring me upstairs to the philosophy room and put me in this little school desk and then just like drop stacks in front of me. I'd sign them, they'd pick them up and move them. I have photographs that have shown how delightful this process is. It's always a lot of fun. And they've hosted several of my book launches here in the city. And they're indispensable, and they're such a part of like San Francisco fabric, and just everybody who works there is lovely and interesting.
And they're super scrappy. I mean,
yeah.
What I've been noticing is like, I think the bookstores that survive, if they can make it through, they're going to have tools now. And I'm seeing so much more social media and so many more innovative things that people are kind of learning on the fly. The other thing is that I think, and I want to get this across with these podcasts, and I've been saying it in every one, that people need to know they can pre-order it in an independent bookstore.
Yeah.
I think there's this mentality that you can only pre-order on a certain website, and you can go to your local indie bookstore and make that the place that you do all of your pre-orders. And I have had wonderful experiences. Mine is Books Inc., but I do go out to Flying Colors Comics, and I go to Green Apple when I can. And these places like can do a lot of the things that maybe some of them couldn't have done 5 or 10 years ago, but they're getting scrappy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a statement. I didn't have a question.
Like, yep, that's true. It's one of those bookstores that has like a sales bin out front and a big rack of books and a big green awning out front. And so it's just like if you're there, you can't help but stop. You can't help but be drawn to it and gravitate toward it. And I've seen like non-book people so many times be like, ooh, what's this place? It just, and they're open late too. So they're, you know, they're like good for date night, and they're good for, I mean, people just like bring their kids in on a Saturday afternoon just for something to do. And I feel like this bookstore exemplifies what it means to be a pillar of your community, because they get to know their customers, they get to know the authors that live nearby. And I mean, I will pass by other famous local authors when I'm there, just they're just shopping. And you're just like, oh, hey, Lemony Snicket, how's it going? Hey, Wendy McNaughton, how are you? Like, it's awesome. And so, I don't know, I think when you grow up with something like that in your neighborhood, you're never not going to want to go there when you visit home, or, you know, to take your own kids there. And long live Green Apple Books. I hope they never leave. And
long live Green Apple.
The likelihood of that, even during these struggling times, seems possibly like it could work out, because they've got now 2 satellite locations.
Mm-hmm.
They opened Books on the Park right around the corner from where Black Oak Books used to be. So I'm like, okay, finally, like my my Sunset District bookstore is back. And I love that neighborhood, too. That's probably my favorite neighborhood in all of San Francisco. It's like the 9th and Irving corridor. So get my books, get my ice cream, get my grapevine, get on the the train, and you know, Golden Gate Park is right there. It just
lovely.
Go to the aquarium afterwards. I don't know. I'm a nerd for San Francisco, so it's the best.
I've been biking more, and that's opened up the city for me.
Nice.
Just discovering all these neighborhoods. Well, yeah, I hope people adopt a bookstore. Adopt one near you. You know, if there's a bookstore near you, even in the pandemic, a lot of them are doing curbside service. Some of them you can go in now if you're comfortable with that. But I hope people use this time to adopt an independent bookstore. And if not, go to Green Apple. It's worth the trip. Destination bookstores. There should be destination bookstores, like destination restaurants.
And if you don't live here, you can go to their website and they will ship you anything for 99 cents.
Signed. Find Raina Telgemeier.
Yeah, that's a true too. Yeah.
Just one more question. You've been very generous with your time. I wanted to just ask you about the Bay Area and the sense of place in your work. And it's kind of a bookend because we started with that. But
mm-hmm.
I love that in Smile, just in the middle of Smile, Loma Prieta happens.
It does.
And I'm sure, like, anybody who doesn't live in the Bay Area, I'm sure you've had questions about that. You know, did that really happen? Oh, yeah, it happened if you lived here. But Sutro, you'll just, you know, flipping through the book, and there's a panel with Sutro Tower in there. And I just wanted to ask you about the Bay Area and that sense of place in your books, and where that started, and if you see that continuing.
It started with nostalgia, because I was living in New York when I started writing these memoirs, and I missed home so much, but didn't really know how to articulate that. And it's you know, it's a complicated relationship. I hate the fog here. So I'm like, I love San Francisco, but I hate the weather, except for on those like nice days in September, like today, where it's beautiful. But so just finding ways to illustrate that was really satisfying for me. So I found myself just like looking at old photographs and being like, oh, my mom's house, it's so dorky, but I love drawing it. And just trying to capture the spirit of the place, which I don't know, it turns out this town is not like any other town. And I took it for granted until I was away from it, and then realized how much quirk and how much charm and delight it had. So I've really started to enjoy the interstitial illustrations between the chapters in my stories where I just go for broke and it's like, yep, here's Sutro Tower and like the fog rolling over the hills and into Noe Valley and stuff. And yeah, it just like scratched such an itch. And then I moved back and continued. And so now it's less about nostalgia and it's more about accuracy. Like, okay, I can go to the place. Oh no, they've changed the architecture. Hey friends, does anybody have photographs that they took during that time? And so it, you know, it just, it's like going on a little history project. And I'm sure you can relate to that as a journalist where you're like digging up facts and looking for old photographs of a place just to kind of give the reader the flavor of what you remember.
Oh, that's my thing. I mean, my favorite stories are the ones that are right in that sweet spot that you can't Google them. So it's like, remember that time that William Shatner wrote a killer whale at Marine World? And it's like, that didn't happen. And then you Google it and there's nothing there. So it's myth.
Right.
And there isn't that much myth left in the world. But when there's myth and it's in your backyard, then you're kind of recreating something almost like it's new again. I don't know how to describe it, but
yeah, there's, I couldn't describe it with words, but I could probably illustrate it somehow and people would just be able to feel it. So when I illustrate the Bay Area, I'm trying to capture a feeling, a mood, a smell, a light source, you know, all the different really intangible things. But, you know, I can look at a painting from the 1700s and I can feel those things in a single image. So why can't we do the same thing through art now? And I like the idea that illustrating San Francisco in 1989 and talking about an earthquake, and now, you know, 20 years later, kids are reading about it and they're like, what is this earthquake? And I get these cool letters and stories from like parents and children where the kids are the age that I was in the book, which in Smile is like 11 and 12. And their parents are my age, just because of the way the timing has worked out. So their parents are all about the same age as me. So like suddenly the kid is like, hey mom, is this, do you remember this? And the mom's like, oh my gosh, let me tell you a story. And then the kid's mind is blown because they're like, you were the same age as Raina when this happened? And Raina's your age now? Like kids don't believe that I'm a grown up. So when I like walk onto the stage, they're like, what? How old are you? Oh my gosh, you're my mom's age. And it just cracks me up. But I like that it opens up that conversation. I like that kids and parents are able to, you know, put themselves in each other's shoes and talk about an experience. And it just sort of comes alive for them. So, yeah, call it nostalgia, call it whatever you want to. I don't want it to be like sappy nostalgia. I just want it to be like, you know, it was cool. Here's the deodorant brands that we used in 1989. And like for my parents and adult readers who are enjoying the books alongside their kids, they're like, yep, I remember how that smelled. Yeah. Teen spirit. So yeah, well, it's been fun.
Yeah, no.
That's where I wanted to go with all this, Peter, was I'm going to talk about deodorant based on your question. Yeah. So brought it where I wanted to bring it.
Well, the Chronicle Archive is open to you if you ever need it.
All right.
We have an intact archive. It's a magical place. It's amazing what's in there. It's like frozen in time. We had these librarians and photographers, and they were like a religious order. I mean, they just, it's all there, you know. Thank you so much for coming on. I went way over the amount of time that I said I was going to. I think your books, it reminds me of Judy Blume. And when I was a kid, I had my parents, I had my friends, but I also had Judy Blume kind of speaking truth and getting me through some things that I don't know what to say, except it made me feel okay.
Yeah.
And I realize, I mean, I don't know if it's going to make it in the podcast, but my son just got orthodonture and came up to the microphone and is talking about how, you know, he related to your book and it made his experience easier in a way that I couldn't have helped him. And I didn't want to say all this in the beginning and make the whole thing awkward, but I hope you realize, you know, that's just helping so many kids and it's such a good thing. Certainly something that's been special to our family. And I really appreciate you coming on. I think you do incredible work.
Thanks. It makes me happy for sure.
Yeah. So, hope you'll come on again and, good luck with whatever you've got coming up next. And thanks a lot for coming on Total SF.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Darling, it's 2 a.m. It's time for closing.
You are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you to my guest, Raina Telgemeier. Total SF is a production of the Chronicle. Our music is The Tide Will Rise by the Sunset Shipwrecks off their album Community, and Cable Car Bell Ringing by 8-time champion Byron Cobb. Support Total SF in the newsroom that creates it by treating yourself to a digital Chronicle edition at sfchronicle.com/pod.